judges of the United States Court of Appeals and for the Seventh Judicial Circuit. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before this honorable court are admonished to draw near and give their attention as this court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning to everyone. We will skip the first case on this morning's call and return to it later on. So take the second case first, number 03-1086, DFS Secured Healthcare against Caregivers Great Lakes.
Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Portinga.
May it please the court, my name is Andy Portinga, here on behalf of the appellant, Caregivers Great Lakes, and Mark Leitzma. This appeal presents several issues under the Indiana Fraudulent Transfer Act, which I'll refer to as IUFTA. The IUFTA is the Indiana's codification of the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act, which has been enacted by approximately 43 states.
Are there any substantial changes in the Indiana version from the Basic Uniform Act, at least with respect to this litigation?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe so.
Thank you.
The first issue that I'd like to address.
You're not challenging on appeal, I gather, the valuation of these assets, is that right?
That's correct. That is not an issue that we have pursued on appeal.
Seems to me that most everything else turns on that, so I'm not sure where we go from there, but go ahead.
Well, not quite. Sorry. What I was wondering is what evidence was submitted to the district court that the assets are still available for reconveyance in substantially the same form?
Yeah, and let me address that, Your Honor. That is DFS bears the burden of proof in this case. And if our position is that DFS won a money judgment, they need to show that the assets were not available or had devalued in value. DFS did not carry that burden. They did not introduce any evidence that the assets were not available.
So, in other words, you're saying that was not even explored in the district court?
I think that's correct, Your Honor.
Well, the assets were available, I think, weren't they?
The assets were available, yes, as of the time of the trial, that's true. The assets we're talking about here is furniture, computers, and most significantly the Medicare provider number.
Well, I assume that he bought this outfit to get the number, didn't he? Isn't that the principal asset that they had?
That's true. The Medicare provider number is the unique asset here, which the furniture and the computers are sort of run of the mill, but the Medicare provider number is the unique asset here.
Was the default judgment obtained by DFS prior to the transfer based on pre-transfer claims, or was it concerning debts that arose after the transfer of the assets to CGL?
Yeah, thank you, Your Honor. The default judgment was obtained after the asset transfer. The asset transfer was January 1st, 1999. The default judgment was June 20th of 2000. And this goes to the issue of the legality of the contract, between DFS and CPI. And the trial court, my client repeatedly argued that DFS wasn't a present creditor. It didn't have a claim because its claim was based on an illegal contract. And the trial court never addressed that issue. It didn't address it because it said, well, DFS got a default judgment, and that default judgment makes them as much of a creditor as anyone can be.
Well, did you argue in the district court specifically that DFS could not be a creditor because the judgment wasn't entered until after the assets were transferred?
My client never had the opportunity to argue that, Your Honor, because that came up at the end when the trial court entered the judgment. Before the judgment was entered, my client repeatedly argued that the contract was illegal, and therefore they weren't a present creditor. But when the trial court entered the judgment and entered its opinion, it said, well, I'm not going to address that question. I'm not going to answer the question of legality because they got a default judgment, that makes them a creditor as much as anyone can be.
When you say the contract was illegal, of course, this provision, I think, just said the government isn't going to pay any assignee of receivables. is to protect the government against having to decide who is entitled to the to be paid for the receivables, I assume. But does that make the contract illegal and void, as you're claiming? I'm not sure one follows from the other.
Yes, it does, Your Honor. And I would point the court to the legislative history that we outlined in our brief. And the history is this. In 1972, Congress amended the Medicare Act to prohibit the factoring of receivables. And there's no dispute here that, that's what this contract is. It's the sale and purchase of government health care receivables. Mr. Wiener, the principal DFS, acknowledged that. In 1972, Congress said, well, these factoring contracts are harming the Medicare program. We're going to make them illegal. After the 1972 amendment, these factoring companies...
Well, they didn't say they were going to make them illegal. They just said, we're not going to pay anybody who's an assignee, isn't it?
Well, again, I would point the court to the legislative history, the House report, that details the problem with the factoring contracts, that the intent was to prohibit these types of arrangements. And after the 1972 amendment, factorers such as DFS said, well, basically what I believe the court is saying is that, well, we can get around this. We can get around it by using a power of attorney. So these factorers would obtain a power of attorney, collect the receivables through the power of attorney. And in 1995, Congress said, no, we can't do that. You're undermining our intent here in the 1972 amendment. And it prohibited the use of powers of attorney. Now, what we have here is DFS is saying, well, in response to that, we amended this contract so that we're only getting the proceeds, and that cures the problem, essentially. But again, if you look at the legislative history, it's clear that Congress was identifying a problem here and speaking to this problem and trying to prohibit.
Yeah, this is prohibit a pledge, which is essentially what they're saying now, I guess. The accounts receivable is pledged to security, and that the amounts are paid to the debtor, but the debtor is required to turn over the proceeds to the creditor. Is that illegal as well?
2 points. One, if in fact the proceeds are security, that is not illegal. But that is not DFS's position in this case. They are not arguing that this was a secure transaction. Mr. Wiener was very clear that he purchased the receivables. His testimony was unequivocal about that. Now I'd just like to flesh out the arrangement here between DFS and CPI, in that CPI...
Forgive me for one moment. Before you do, I have a very bottom line kind of question.
Yep.
Am I wrong feeling that this case really concerns Indiana law questions upon which no law seems to exist?
With regards to the remedy that the trial court entered, I believe that's correct. That is, certainly the question of whether punitive damages are allowed is a question of first impression.
Well, would this be the kind of case that we should be certifying to the Indiana court?
Your Honor, I think that it may be appropriate, and the court certainly has the discretion to do that. I think the other principle to come into play on that issue, the issue of the fact that this is an issue of first impression, is the principle of federalism. And what we have here is we have a federal court, a federal judge, sitting in diversity. He's essentially a guest in the state law arena. And in that type of situation, I'll point out, this case was filed in federal court. It wasn't removed. Plaintiffs chose the forum. They chose to be in federal court. And in a situation where you have a federal court sitting in diversity, and unsettled questions of state law, this court has been clear that the federal judge should be cautious, should be conservative. If somebody is going to take Indiana state law into a new direction or expand Indiana state law, it should be an Indiana state judge, somebody who is accountable to the people of Indiana. A federal judge...
There's nothing new about the remedy of punitive damages, is it? That's been around for a long time.
Punitive damages in the general have been around a long time in the context of the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act. It is a unique and novel approach. There is no guidance from the Indiana appellate courts on this issue. There's not a lot of guidance.
Apparently, they're allowed in Ohio, but not Connecticut. Is that?
There is a divergence of opinion among the states, and we've acknowledged that in our briefs. I would point on the issue of punitive damages, I would point the court to the language of 18B, which is the only provision in the statute that provides for money damages. And 18B is a very restrictive provision, and it provides for money damages, but only in limited circumstances, only against limited people in limited circumstances and limited amounts. You can only get them against transferees, and I'd like to come back to that issue. You have to meet the precursors to that provision, that is, the transaction has to be avoidable, and has to, and there's the clause except as otherwise provided. You have to meet those conditions. And then 18B says, if you do get money damages, you only get them in the lesser of the value of the asset transferred or the amount of the claim. Mm-hmm. There's a cap. There's a ceiling on the amount of money damages that's available under 18B. And because of that language in the statute, and because of the Indiana Supreme Court's guidance and statutory construction, where the Indiana Supreme Court has said, look, when we have a statutory cause of action that lists the remedies, we're going to interpret that restrictively. We're not going to allow punitive damages if they're not specifically provided for. On that basis, the trial court, again, a federal court in Indiana University, erred in taking Indiana law where it had never been before. And the trial court, in Indiana University, unaccountable to the people of Indiana, should not have been the person, the party to do that. I'd like to come back to Judge Kudigy's first issue regarding the valuation of the asset. And I don't think the valuation of the asset, that issue is germane to the rest, is dispositive on the rest of this appeal.
Well, as a practical matter, it's pretty, it may not be dispositive, but it's pretty influential in looking at these facts.
Let me say two things on that. First of all, if these assets were truly worth $470,000, then presumably BFS would have been happy to take them. I mean, if they're really worth $470,000, BFS could take them, sold them on the market, and recovered the amount of the asset. The fact of the matter is they're not. Now, we didn't appeal the valuation of the asset, but that's not germane to really one of the principal issues here, which is Mr. Leitzman's personal liability. The trial court entered judgment against both of my clients, both Mr. Leitzma and the corporation. The only basis for a judgment against Mr. Leitzma was transferee liability, i.e. that he'd be transferee. And the as I mentioned before, Section 18B only provides for money judgments against transferees in another class, which is not at issue here. Transferee is not defined in the statute. But the statute, Section 18, is based on the Bankruptcy Code, Section 550, which uses basically the same language. And this court has been very clear about what who a transferee is and isn't under the Bankruptcy Code, and we can rely on that case law in determining who's a transferee under IUFTA. A transferee is more than a possessor, more than a holder, and more than a conduit of the assets. To be a transferee, there has to be dominion and control over the assets transferred.
Could he have been an agent?
He could have been an agent, but being an agent does not make one a transferee. And in the bonded financial case, which is really the principal case on the meaning of the term transferee, Judge Easterbrook gives the hypothetical of A, who gives a check to B, and B is acting as an agent of C. And in that type of situation, the initial transferee is C, not B. B falls out of the picture. The most that you can possibly read...
Was this a jury question here?
Mm-hmm. Your Honor, I believe this is a mixed question of law. In fact, it turns on the meaning of the term transferee and whether Mr. Leitzma exercised dominion
and control. My guess is that Mr. Leitzma intended to have this transfer to a corporation, but he proceeded pretty sloppily, and maybe he's not entitled to prevail on that point.
Well, let me say this, Your Honor.
He didn't create the corporation until after the transfer, for one thing. He didn't sign his name on behalf of the corporation for another thing, I think.
Well, let me address this. First of all, creating the timing of the creation of the corporation. Mr. Leitzman signed the articles of the corporation 4 days after the asset purchase agreement was signed. The asset transfer had not occurred at that point. The mechanism was in place to form the corporation before the assets were transferred. Now, the Articles of Corporation state that the corporation is effective January 1st, 1999. The asset purchase agreement does contain a closing date of December 22nd, 1999. There is no evidence in the record, however, that the closing actually took place on December 22nd. Mr. Leisman said, well, in terms of the closing, all that was left to be done was the payment of the purchase price. And the record is undisputed that that was done in January of 1999. And with regards to the fact that you didn't sign on behalf of the corporation, the asset purchase agreement defines the buyer. It defines the buyer as Mr. Leisman or a corporation to be formed by him. Either one or the other. Can't be both. The asset purchase agreement also sets forth certain obligations of the buyer. The buyer has to enter a new employment agreement with the former principal of the PPI. The buyer has to execute a lease. The buyer has to pay the purchase price. On this record, there is no dispute that all of those conditions were performed by TGL, the corporation. None of them were performed by Mark Leisman. Mark Leisman did not act as the buyer, and he did not perform the obligations of the buyer. Going back to the issue of isn't this a jury question, to the extent that this is a question of fact, that doesn't mean that it's so sacrosanct that it's unassailable on appellate review. Even factual findings have to be supported by sufficient evidence. Can't be supported by a mere scintilla of the evidence or by mere speculation. There has to be something in the record. And this court has to review the trial court's determination that there was sufficient evidence de novo. And in this case, there simply is no evidence in the record that Mr. Leisman exercised dominion and control over CPI's assets. The most that can even be inferred from the record was that he was a mere conduit or an agent for the asset transfer. And that does not make him a transferee. I see that my light is on. If the court has any further questions at this point, I'll try to answer them. Otherwise, I'll save my remaining time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Portinger.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We'll hear now from Mr. Nichols.
Good morning, Your Honors, Counsel. May it please the court, my name is Christopher Nichols, and I represent DFS in this matter. Let me begin by clarifying what is not at issue in this case. Despite the numerous and lengthy post-trial processes initiated by the defendants, defendants do not challenge the basis for the decision that there was, in fact, a fraudulent transfer. They do not challenge on appeal the basis for determining the amount of damages accruing from that fraudulent transfer. They do not contest on appeal the prerequisite for finding a punitive
damage. Well, if you claim the damages aren't available, if you have to reconvey the assets themselves. So I'm not sure whether they're challenging the amount of the damages, but I don't see whether that's the relevant consideration here. That's one reason why there's some basis for the idea that you ought to reconvey the assets rather than have them valued as damages, because valuations, as we all know, can be all over the lot. And just the number they came up with here, I think, is pretty central to the whole case, because if these assets were worth, quote-unquote, $470,000, then there may be a practical basis for punitive damages and everything else that hangs on that number. But if they're only worth $50,000 or $100,000, that makes a different case out of it, it seems to me.
Well, and as to that very point, Your Honor, there is not an issue on appeal as to whether indeed a fraudulent transfer happened.
Well, of course, you don't have a fraudulent transfer unless the assets are less than, are not compensatory. I mean, the amount paid for the assets is not fair market value. That's what creates the fraudulent transfer. So
right.
Again, valuation is central, I think.
I think it's important for us to know what evidence there is that the transfer was initially to Leisman.
The evidence in this record was that Mr. Leisman controlled the entire transaction. It was his election to decide whether the deal was to be to him or to a corporation to be formed later.
But when CPI disclosed the change in ownership of the provider number, CPI indicated it was transferring the asset to CGL, not to Leisman. And that, it would seem, would indicate that the transfer was directly to the corporation, wouldn't it?
No, Your Honor.
No.
And the reason is, again, Mr. Leesma controlled every aspect of this transaction. He could have made Caregivers Great Lakes effective as a corporation as of the day of the transaction, or 4 days later when he signed the papers. He could have made it effective, but he didn't do that. And then he and others acting at his direction exercised dominion and control over these assets during the remainder of the month of December, when the corporation did not yet exist. We live in the real world, and those of us who have seen these transactions know that what typically happens is you create an ABC Corp or a new corp, and the transaction is made to that new corp entity and then ultimately to the corporation that's going to be named later, and that's done for exactly this reason, to make sure that no individual has personal liability. Mr. Leesma did not take care of those details. Mr. Leesma set the closing date. He set how the transaction was going to be done, who signed the document. He didn't sign the document in a representative capacity. And he exercised control over those assets. Patients and patient records were transferred during the month of December when Caregivers Great Lakes did not even exist. So it's clear that with all this evidence before it, the jury and the district court had a basis for determining that Mr. Leesma was acting as the initial transferee. Whether there was a subsequent transferee doesn't matter. The statute provides for transferees in succession and liability to each. So this is not an unheard of situation where more than one person could be liable for a fraudulent transfer. And the fact that the jury assessed $800,000 in punitive damages against Mr. Leesma would indicate to me, at least, and I would think to most observers, that indeed they believe that he was an initial transferee, that he did control this process, and that he intended to profit by this process. The corporation or its assets were valued at $470,000. The jury made that determination after listening to expert testimony. The district court heard
the
testimony and accepted it.
I read the expert testimony too, but as I say, the other side said it was worth $20,000, and that was the accountant who was advising Leesma about this transaction.
Right.
So he may have entered into it in pretty good faith, assuming he got that kind of advice.
Well, the evidence was that the defendant's expert was no expert at all, but he was the inside man, and he's coming in trying to validate the very transaction that he orchestrated. But the ultimate issue here is they have not appealed the determination as to whether there was a fraudulent transfer or the value of that fraudulent transfer, so it is not an issue before this court. The only issue is, assuming that those elements have been proven, what are the appropriate remedies
before
this
court? Well, how then would you respond to the argument that the Indiana Supreme Court has stated that a legislature is presumed to have intentionally excluded punitives when a cause of action lists available remedies, but it doesn't list punitive damages? And as a corollary, oh, God, it's the end of the session.
It is, and it's going to be
Is there any Indiana case in which the court has held that punitives are available despite a listing of remedies that fails to mention it, based solely on a general clause, such as this Section 20?
Your Honor, the Indiana Supreme Court has not had to address that issue in any context. We do not read the case that apparently the court's referring to that was cited by defendants as broadly as that. What that was dealing with was the situation where the legislature created a brand new remedy that had never existed before, that it had come up with a list of forms of relief for that new act, and apparently had excluded one possible option. Here, punitive damages had been awarded by other courts under the same model law. Section 20 has this catch-all provision that says that the law of this statute is to be supplemented by the common law of fraud and all these other things. So the only way to read Section 20 is that punitive damages are a necessary component. Punitive damages are not meant to be compensatory. That's the main flaw in defendant's argument. They're saying, well, look at Section 18 because Section 18 talks about the relief for the valuation of the asset. Great, that's That deals with that one issue, actual damages. The punitive damages would never be included there.
Would you be terribly upset if we certified to the Indiana Supreme Court?
At this point, I would, Your Honor, because we're looking at the summer of 2004 and a deal that was done in December of 98. Justice has been delayed substantially in this case, and if we wait another year or two for the Indiana Supreme Court to address this issue and then for the matter to come back to this court for resolution, there's a great likelihood that there will be no assets against which to execute. The whole point that defendants have not contested any judgment against the corporation shows that that corporation has been run into the ground and it has little value. If Mr. Leesma gets another 2 years to defray his assets or hide those assets, we don't know because we've been delayed.
Well, of course, he didn't intend to operate this as a separate business. He's in this business himself. I assume he just took it over for the Medicare number and the customer list and things like that. And on this, why can't, isn't a proper remedy here the reconveyance of these assets? You talked in your brief about a business, but there wasn't any conveyance of a business. They're just conveyance of some assets that are pretty well defined. Why couldn't you just reconvey those and go back to square one?
Well, again, Your Honor, that's form over substance. In today's world, we sell corporations by selling the assets as a group but shedding all the liability. That's what happened here. So this was an ongoing business. It was valued as an ongoing business.
No, but this man is already in this business. Why would he operate this business separately from the one he's already in?
This man has a number of businesses, and so he already testified at trial that he had transferred patients between entities out of Caregivers Great Lakes or out of CPI and into another corporation that's not even a party to this. That testimony was presented at trial. So he owns a number of corporations, and he can run one into the ground and have the other succeed at its detriment, and it means nothing to him. But the point is, Your Honor, that we are now looking 5 years past the time this deal was done. What might have been a practical form of relief back then is not a practical form of relief now.
Why isn't it practical?
Take the example of somebody fraudulently transfers a $100,000 collector automobile. That automobile is transferred, it's driven into the ground, it's beat up, it's crashed, it's now worth about $2,000 on the open market.
We're just talking about the furniture and some,
it can't be reconveyed.
Some account books, aren't we?
No,
all
we're not,
we got
Your Honor.
The furniture, books of account, Medicare
we're
number,
talking,
and I don't know what else.
But we're talking about a cash stream, Your Honor.
Hmm?
What we're talking about is an income stream that this business represented.
Well, this company was losing money before it was transferred, before these assets were transferred.
Well, that's one person's testimony, Your Honor. There was other testimony that this business was a viable entity and it was worth some real money, and the jury believed that. And Judge Miller, in his considerable experience, believed that as well. But because of the substantial delay that's occurred and the inability for us to value those assets today versus the time of trial, it's impractical and unrealistic to say that reconveyance is a realistic remedy here. But also, if that was defendant's position, they should have put that issue in the final pretrial order. It's really a defense. They're trying to turn it around and say, we should have proven the negative. That issue was never preserved for trial. That issue was not raised in summary judgment. That issue was not in the final pretrial order. If they're claiming that there was some sort of pecking order, they should have raised that issue with the judge. They should have presented issue at trial on it. And then we would have had a chance to present a full record to this court. But for the defendants to come in at this point and say, well, we think that assets are still available for reconveyance based on an incomplete record that they didn't make any effort to preserve is really turning the law on its head in this case.
How long was the jury trial?
Jury trial was 4 days, Your Honor. And again, that was 4 days of evidence by a number of individuals. And the jury rendered an opinion. The judge decided at the end of that trial that certain of its rulings were to be advisory, but that is, the relief rulings were to be advisory by the jury. The finding as to liability, I do not believe, was advisory. But the delays, we can't really understand.
On the so-called illegality of this transaction.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Could you explain your position on the contention that this was an illegal credit transaction.
Well, I think Your Honor's question earlier really hit the nail on the head. There's a difference between illegality and unenforceability against the government. The government saying that we as a third-party payor, are not going to be obligated under these contracts because we don't think that they're necessarily good things. Although I will dispute whether Congress was really concerned about the same kind of transaction that DFS had here. But again, the issue is whether the government is going to be bound by these contracts. It never said they were illegal. The statute doesn't say they're illegal. The regulations don't say they're illegal. There's nothing to address that that point. But it's also water under the bridge. The issue is, were we a creditor? And the statute defines a creditor as someone who has a claim. Not a liquidated claim, not a claim reduced to judgment, but just a claim.
But your position is that it was a sale of accounts receivable, not a pledge. Is that correct?
It was a pledge of a money stream, if you will, Your Honor. I mean, the money flowed to CPI, and then they had to pay
up. Well, I mean, if it's really a pledge, I don't think you're entitled to collect the receivables. But if it's a sale, you are, isn't it? The difference?
I'm not sure that is the difference, Your Honor, but again, that wasn't an issue at trial. The legality of the contract was not an issue at trial. The only issue that could properly be raised before the district court was whether DFS had a claim, and it did have a claim at the time it initiated suit and at the time the transfer happened, and that claim was then later reduced to judgment prior to the time of trial. So not only is there no dispute that we had a claim, which is all the statute requires, but that claim was ultimately liquidated. It was reduced to a federal judgment. That federal judgment is unassailable by a third party who is not a party to that contract. And there's ample case law that they cannot come in as a third party and attack that. If they're allowed to do that, what's the difference between that and a garnishee defendant coming in and saying, well, I don't want to withhold these funds because we don't think that the underlying judgment's valid? We're going to have no finality in judgments at all if defendant's argument is allowed to prevail and go forward. The issue again was that we were a present creditor, that claim existed, defendants knew about our claim because there was ample testimony that Mr. Leesmer was aware of DFS and its claim at the time of the transfer. All that testimony came in with regard to the conversion count that's not in dispute here any longer. So once those elements were proven, then the jury and Judge Miller were well within their rights to find that a fraudulent transfer occurred here. And again, the finding of a determination as to a fraudulent transfer is not challenged, merely the issue of relief. Inasmuch as the statute provides for damages, Section 20 provides for supplemental remedies, and numerous other states have enacted just this kind of, or enforced just this kind of relief. In fact, this court has even upheld monetary damages in a fraudulent transfer case. In recent years, it's really disingenuous to say that all of a sudden that's a novel issue. The statute is what it is. The fact that Indiana does not render nearly as many appellate decisions as other states really doesn't affect the fact that the Model Act was adopted by that legislature. Certain remedies were provided for therein. There was a general catch-all provision to supplement that. And Judge Miller, who's been sitting in the state of Indiana either as a state court judge or a federal judge for 25 years, rendered
a Supreme Court said
rule.
We can't consider that.
Pardon me, Your Honor?
The Supreme Court has said we cannot consider that. We cannot show any deference to the ruling of the district court because the district court is a judge, a member of the bar of that state and sits in that state. It has to be, it's up to us.
Well, it is up to you, Your Honors, but Judge Miller performed an analysis that I would submit that this court should perform as well.
I think you're engaging in judicial personalia that makes no sense, though, in terms of the merits of your case in this court.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
You're engaging in judicial personalia, which makes no sense and is irrelevant in terms of the merits of your case in this court. It's up to the three of us to read the law and decide whether you're right or wrong.
I agree with that, Your Honor, and my position simply is that the same analysis that was performed by the district court, if performed here by the three of you, would come to the same conclusion that looking at the history of Indiana jurisprudence, it is not unusual that there are not 100 cases out there under this Fraudulent Transfer Act, and there was a careful, disciplined decision made here, although it took too long, and I would ask that this court affirm that decision in rendering its ruling.
All decisions made by the jury were advisory, is that right?
That is not right.
Is right?
The jury's ruling as to relief was advisory. The jury's ruling as to liability was not advisory, and it's notable that its determination as to liability has not been challenged on appeal.
That's pretty unusual, isn't it?
It certainly is, Your Honor. And again, we think that underscores the fact that Caregivers Great Lakes as an entity, as a collection of assets, is no longer of significant value because there's been no effort made to protect it. Simply, the arguments and the conclusions as to Mr. Leesma are in play here. And I think the inferences that flow from that are significant.
How about the jury verdict as a punitive? That was advisory, is that correct?
Judge Miller determined that it was advisory. Whether I personally agree with that or not is irrelevant because he came up with the same amount the jury did. And so, again, other than some delay, we ended up with the same result that we would have had it not been advisory. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Nichols. How much time does Mr. Portinga have? 4 minutes?
Your Honors, on the issue, pardon me, on the issue of Mr. Leesma's personal liability as a sanctuary, DFS's counsel has represented that Mr. Leesma exercised dominion and control of these assets in December of 1998. And my response to that is, where's the citation? Let's see the evidence. Where is it in the record? There is no evidence in the record that Mr. Leesma personally exercised dominion and control over these assets. The assets we're talking about are furniture, computers, and the Medicare provider number, most significantly. The Medicare provider number is subject to regulation. It's part of the Medicare program. If there's a transfer of that number, it has to be disclosed to the Department of Health and Human Services. The record is clear that only one transfer was disclosed. It was transferred from CPI to CGL. And Mr. Leesma unequivocally testified he never intended to have control over that. With regard to the furnitures and computers, there's no evidence in the record that Mark Leesma even took possession, let alone title, to those assets. At the end of the day, all we have is mere speculation that, well, maybe in the end of December, maybe Mr. Leesma had dominion over these assets. But a verdict, a judgment cannot be based on mere speculation. There has to be sufficient evidence. It has to be more than a scintilla evidence.
This question was not submitted to the jury either, I gather, about whether he had the dominion over the assets.
The jury in their verdict form determined that there was liability on the Fraudulent Transfer Act for both defendants. The jury, it was not broken down such that there was a separate question.
There weren't any specific factual findings that you're talking about, no?
They were not special interrogatories or anything along mm-hmm. that line. DFS's counsel refers to Section 20 and the purpose of that. Section 20 of the Act is the supplementary provisions. The key language to Section 20 is the introductory clause, which says, unless superseded by this chapter, the principles of law and equity supplement the Act. Here, we have a provision in 18B that delineates when money damages are available. It's a very restrictive provision. It restricts as to who against they can be awarded, when they can be awarded, and the amount that they can be awarded. The Act supersedes the common law with regards to money damages. It doesn't incorporate the whole of the common law with regards to money damages. On the issue, DFS's counsel has raised the issue of whether the issue of whether reconveyance is a proper remedy was properly presented to the trial court. And I'll point out to the panel that this was a question that the trial court explicitly asked for a briefing on. The trial court, during the trial, made some comments that he didn't think that money damages were allowed under IUFTA. And then after the trial, he issued an order saying, I'm not sure about this, and I want to see briefs on it. The issue was clearly presented to the trial court.
What's your position on the adequacy of reconveyance of these assets as opposed to damages?
My position is that the trial court should have ordered the reconveyance of the assets as opposed to...
Your opponent, of course, says they declined in value and that the Leesma paid no attention to them and so forth.
And as I said before, I believe in response to Judge Rovner's question, that's their burden. If they want a money judgment, they've got to show a decline in value. and they didn't meet that burden at trial. They didn't introduce any evidence on that.
Did the district court directly address whether the assets were available for reconveyance in a form that was comparable to the form at the time of the initial fraudulent transfer?
Well, I guess you can answer it this way. The trial court, at the end of the trial, knew that reconveyance was an option. It was weighing reconveyance or money damages, and it didn't think the money, initially, the trial judge didn't think the money damages were available. That's why the trial judge asked for briefings. So to that extent, I would say that the trial court did address that issue.
Directly?
I would refer the court to the trial court's order post-trial, which says that he would like briefing on that issue. That is the extent to which the trial court addressed that issue, I believe.
So what happened after the briefing?
The trial court made the determination that money damages were available and adopted the jury's recommended verdict.
And didn't discuss reconveyance again?
Did not discuss reconveyance.
Yes, he does. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
My red light is on unless there's further questions.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Indeed, our thanks to both attorneys.